Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Last week, if you will remember, we recorded our 365th unique interview, allowing you to listen to one episode every day for an entire year and never get bored. Unless it is a leap year, which would mean that you'd have to use February 29th to listen to a rerun. Well, we don't want to leave you high and dry during the leap year, so we promised last week to record at least one more episode so that you will be covered, and today we're making good on that promise. But don't worry, we still have more great stuff in the queue, so stay tuned with us and also tell a friend because we enjoy the company. My guest today is Professor Shachar Pinsker, an associate professor of Hebrew literature and culture in the Jean and Samuel Frankel Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. He also has an appointment in the Near Eastern Studies Department at that same university. Dr. Pinsker earned his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley and Graduate Theological Union in 2001, and since that time he has been a prolific author, publishing several dozen articles in scholarly journals, as well as two books entitled Literary Passports, The Making of Modernist Hebrew Fiction in Europe, that's out with Stanford University Press, and A Rich Brew, How Cafes Created Modern Jewish Culture, which is being released as we speak from New York University Press. The former book, Literary Passports, received the Jordan Schmitzer Best Book Award from the Association for Jewish Studies, and the latter book, A Rich Brew, will be the topic of our discussion today. Not satisfied with just two books, Shachar is working on a third one tentatively entitled A Silent Language, Yiddish in Israeli Literature and Culture. We will link to his current books, the Frankel Center, related podcast, and lots of other fun tidbits on our website for you to peruse at your leisure. So please check us out at your convenience. Shachar, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
A few months ago, I received a catalog of currently published and forthcoming books from NYU Press, and your book really leapt to my attention from the pages because I'm a huge fan of coffee, probably drinking about 48 ounces or more a day, and I love coffee houses too, just being able to sit, relax, maybe do some reading, and also watch people and observe how they behave and interact. I always think that's kind of fun. So this book had to be a must-do on this podcast. Tell us a little bit about your academic interest, how they developed, and what brought a young Shachar Pinsker to think about graduate school and take up the study of Hebrew literature, and then what in specific led you to think about Jewish culture and coffee houses?
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be on this podcast and to talk about this topic. So if I'm trying to reflect and think about the young Shachar Pinsker and what led me to the graduate school and to the work that I'm doing right now, it really goes back many years ago. I was a student at the Hebrew University, and I studied international relations and literature, and I thought that literature is just kind of a hobby on the side. But then I really became interested in comparative literature, Jewish literature, Hebrew literature, in theory. I joined this special new honors program at the Hebrew University that was really kind of a graduate program for undergraduate students, and I just really fell in love with doing research and writing papers from the first year. So it was quite at the beginning of my undergraduate studies that I kind of knew that I love research and I love the academic world. Um, although when I finished my BA at the Hebrew University, I took a little bit of break, I did other things, I worked with children, I also worked in a bookstore cafe in Jerusalem, where I met a lot of people, and that, in retrospect, was maybe what led me later on to write this book and to do research on this topic. But, you know, at that time it didn't seem like anything significant on the academic level. I proceeded with MA at the Hebrew University, focusing more on comparative literature and on Hebrew literature. And at that point, I really knew that I want to become an academic, I want to do research. And I left Israel and went to Berkeley, to UC Berkeley, and did this wonderful PhD program in Jewish studies with UC Berkeley and GTU. And at that point, I became very interested. The topic of my dissertation was about Hebrew modernism in Europe, which really fascinated me. What causes people, young Jews who had a yeshiva education and came from traditional background, to write in Hebrew? Was it Zionism? Was it because of literary reasons? Why did they took this language? And how they created this Hebrew modernism at the time of modernism in Europe and all over the world, but how difficult it was to do it in Hebrew. So my dissertation was actually about how Hebrew writers used language from the Talmud and the Midrash, from rabbinic literature, in order to create Hebrew modernist fiction. That was my dissertation. Then I spent a year at Harvard, I went back to Israel, I had a postdoc at Ben-Gurion University, and then I found myself in the middle of the Midwest in University of Michigan. And I became again very interested. I wanted to put the Hebrew modernism in a larger, kind of broader context. And when I worked on my book, Literary Passport, I understood that I have to make it a little broader for a broader audience, for literary scholars who are not just interested in Hebrew, but in modernism in general. Also, not just literary scholars, but also historians and other people who are interested in this really fascinating period. And in my previous book, in Literary Passport, it's divided into three parts. So the first part is about the cities and urban experience in this literature. The second one is about gender and sexuality. And the third one is about the religious experience and the interaction between modernist Hebrew fiction and traditional Jewish texts. And in the first part of the book about the cities, I did a lot of research that is kind of not typical for a literary scholar, or research that is very different in terms of the approach and the materials I was looking for from what I myself used to do, and my teachers and the people who influenced me did. And I started to ask myself, you know, not just what's in the text, but what's in the real world. Where these people lived? Where did they meet? What kind of interaction they had with people who wrote in Yiddish and German and Russian and Polish? You know, you can do all this analysis with just looking at the text. But I became interested in the places themselves. And I found myself again and again coming to coffee houses. And I have to tell you, in the beginning, I thought that, okay, you know, I find all these coffee houses because I love coffee houses. You know, I like walking there. I think like you, I like these places for all these reasons. And really, in the beginning, I thought that I'm finding what I'm looking for because I like these places. It took a while to understand that that's not the case, and really there was something about these places. So I started to collect all kind of materials, both literary and historical, and a few photographs, and I kind of put it on the side, and just a little bit is in the previous book, which is mostly textual analysis. But then I kind of started thinking, what am I going to do with all these materials? You know, I have all these great materials about coffee houses in Europe, in European cities. And at the time, this was 10 years ago, I kind of thought to myself, it's fun, but it's not academic enough, it's not serious enough, it's not something that a literary scholar should work on, and really didn't know what to do with these materials. I actually spoke with a good friend of mine, a colleague who is an editor in Haaretz newspaper, and I told him about the research I was doing and collecting all these materials about coffee houses, and he really liked it, and he said, why don't you write a number of articles, you know, about this topic using these materials? And then I thought, you know, I don't normally write for newspapers. I write articles and books. But I thought, you know what, that's a good opportunity to speak to a larger audience. And I wrote these articles. They were published 1 week after the other in Haaretz newspaper in Hebrew. And I thought that was it. You know, I got it out of my system. It's a topic that is really more kind of suitable for general audience and not as academic. A topic, and you know, that's the end of my engagement with this topic. but it happened to be just the opposite, that it was just the beginning, because I mean the main reason is that so many people were so interested. I don't think there was anything that I've written before that elicited so many responses. People just loved it, and people wrote to me and called me to tell me stories about their family and grandparents, and sent me photographs and materials and asked me questions. So I kind of realized that, okay, there is something there. It is a very interesting topic. And then, of course, I became more aware that it's not just a topic that interests people from all backgrounds, but it's also a very serious academic topic. It's just not the kind of topic that was that I engaged in before. So, you know, I started to read theory and historic texts that deal with the history of the coffee house and theory of the coffee house and Habermas, etc., etc. And then one thing led to the other, and I've been invited to some conferences. There was a conference in London about the Viennese coffee house, and I learned a lot from being in the conference and hearing other people doing research on this topic from different points of view. And at that point, I thought, okay, this is a topic that was something much more than just writing a few articles. And then the other thing that happened was that I focused just on Europe. But then I had all these colleagues and other scholars who told me, well, why you write only about Odessa and Warsaw and Vienna and Berlin? Why don't you write about other places? I said, well, I don't know anything about them. And say, oh, no, in New York there was a really amazing cafe culture and Cafe Royale, and what about in Tel Aviv, and what about in many other places? And I said, well, what about it? I don't know anything about it. Tell me. And then I started doing research and really seeing that this is not just about a specific kind of short period in Europe that I knew very well, connected with Hebrew and its relation with other languages and other literatures and culture, but it's something that is really very central in the creation of modern Jewish culture in many places. And I have a great topic here that really begs for somebody to write about kind of in a serious way, and that's what I did.
It is an excellent book in that respect, too. And you said something early on. You said that, you know, you were looking at these places where people were writing, and a lot of literary scholarship just seems to take the written text as is, as if it came down from on high into the mind of an author. But it really takes place in places, and authors, you know, sit in places, they interact with other people in places, and that really shapes how they view the world, which I think is really neat. And you convey that a lot in your book here. The other thing that you mentioned is that you worked in a bookstore cafe in Jerusalem. for me, that would just be a fascinating job because you get to watch people, right? You're the person that just, you know, brings coffee or cleans plates or things like that. And you're kind of background, but you also get to be that fly on the wall and like, look at people. I wonder what that person is doing. They're busy writing there. Or these two people are talking in, you know, hushed voices. I wonder, that must have been a really fun experience, just kind of being a little social science detective, I guess.
Yeah, it was. It was really a fun experience, and it was actually a place, I mean, it's a place that still exists in Jerusalem, and, you know, I was there just at the beginning when it opened. It was the first one, and very slowly but surely it started to bring many of the most famous and most important Israeli author and also people from all over the world coming and doing readings and interacting with people, so that was definitely a very formative experience in retrospect. Like I said at the time, I didn't think that it's going to be something that I will deal with academically, but it must have made a big impact on me and something that I kind of took with me as I moved on. And the other thing you said is also very correct, and actually it's moving. I think the scholarship is moving in this direction, you know, especially when we talk about modernism, you have this kind of general idea that it's high modernism and people who are writing text, and then, you know, you only focus on the text, and there's a lot of scholarship that is now moving away from that and looking at modernism and other periods in the context of the time and trying to see the writers, where they're coming from, where they're actually meeting other people and the interaction, and kind of what is the relationship between, let's say, the urban experience, the way it conveyed in the literature, and the places where it came from, you know? I mean, the one thing that I try to do in my book all the time is to look at the places themselves as from as much as we can get information from text, from historical sources, from literary sources. But also it's the coffee houses are very important for these writers, for these Jewish writers, as a kind of microcosmos of the urban experience. You know, the coffee house becomes a wonderful place for them to observe and to write about, and kind of something that encapsulates the urban experience, especially when they are immigrants and coming from, you know, small shtetls or town, or moving from one country or one continent to the other. And, you know, it's very difficult to experience the big city and to, you know, the pace of the city and all that. And the coffee house is a kind of relatively closed place, but it's between the inside and the outside, and it becomes a very potent place for writers, not just to sit and write in and to meet other people and to have discussions, but also to write about. And very often we find these fictional places, coffee houses, that people are writing about. But if you know enough the history, you know kind of what it's based on, the places that are the prototypes, because that's where the writers themselves sat and met other people and all these things that were happening.
And one thing I really want to recommend about this book is that you have these historical sources, you reference literary works talking about coffee houses and that, but you also have cartoons from the time and also photographs. I was really drawn to the photographs because I think, I don't know, it's about every 10 pages or so on average, there will be another photograph of a coffee house. Sometimes they're empty, sometimes they have people in them, and it really brings to life the work. As I was reading through this, I could just smell the coffee there. I could kind of get the feel for the buzz and humming that's going around and people talking it's a really wonderful book, well written. I want to talk about coffee houses, though, because we didn't get to talk about coffee houses too much on this podcast. They're obviously important in shaping Jewish culture, but I want to start with thinking about coffee houses in general. And a lot of young folks think these places, they were invented by Starbucks sometime in the 1990s. But and even though Starbucks started out here in Seattle in the 1970s, coffee houses actually have a much deeper history. So tell us a little bit about how coffee houses originated, how they got to Europe, and a little bit about their background.
Right. Okay, yes, so it is a fascinating history, and one that before I started working on this book I knew very little about. But when you see how it moved, you know, I mean, coffee itself, we don't know exactly, it originated some somewhere in Africa, probably in Ethiopia, and then it moved and became very popular. Coffee itself and the institution of the coffee house really emerged in the Ottoman Empire in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century in the context of Islam. So you have people starting drinking coffee and then people gathering together to drink coffee, and it becomes from the very beginning a very social drink. So almost from the beginning of people drinking coffee, there was the institution, and the institution was a place for people to gather, to meet, and it was used. There were actually all kinds of debates whether it's a good thing to do it, to drink coffee and to go to coffee houses. But very quickly, you know, Sufis and people in the context of Islam are starting to use it. It moves to kind of midnight rituals and other elements that coffee enables. And already at the very beginning in the Ottoman Empire, it was between religious culture and secular culture as a place of meeting, and it became very popular moving from places like Mecca to Istanbul and Constantinople, and that really became the kind of the center of cafe culture. It was unknown in Western Europe until that point, and then it was brought over to first to England. That was something that not many people know, but England was the first place in Western Europe, in Christian Europe, that developed cafe culture and coffee houses. But it was always clear at the beginning in England and also in other places, in Venice and then later in Vienna, that it's something that has an aura of otherness. You know, the coffee itself was an exotic drink that was brought over from Africa. It wasn't something like beer or wine that was from the place, that grew, that people were producing in the place itself. And the early coffee houses very much looked like something that comes out of the Ottoman Empire, you know, with the Oriental element of all these Oriental elements came together. But then it became kind of localized in a very interesting way. So you have in London hundreds of coffee houses, which people called a tavern without wine, because it was an alternative to the bars and the pubs that were very popular. And people started calling these places penny universities, because they were places of discussions and of learning, a kind of alternative not just to the tavern and the bar, but also alternative to Oxford and Cambridge and to the places of learning. And very quickly it became very popular. So it moved to Italy and to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and from there to central, or everywhere in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe. By the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, coffee houses were widespread all over Europe, and in certain places like Vienna, they became very localized. So people are talking about typical Viennese cafe, or typical Parisian or Venetian cafe. But I found really fascinating that coffee houses, when you look at this history, there's always some negotiation between the local and the national, and the fact that it's transnational, that it's coming from elsewhere. And this is really where the connection with Jews and Judaism and Jewishness comes into play, because actually some of the people who brought it over from the Ottoman Empire to Western and Central Europe were Sephardic Jews who were involved in the coffee trade, and also opened some of the early coffee houses in Oxford and in other places. But Jews were really among other people, Armenian, Greek. Actually, in all the cities that I'm looking at, The first coffee houses were not opened by local, meaning Russian or Polish or German or Austrian, but by people who came from elsewhere, from the Ottoman Empire and the vicinity. Then later on, Italy or Switzerland, and then they brought it over to these places. So the history of coffee houses is really fascinating, and like I said, it's interesting to see how the kind of the network that you have of trade and Jews moving from one place to another is connected to the spread of the coffee house. Although I have to make it clear that my book is not claiming that, you know, the institution of the coffee house from the very beginning or even later on was ever exclusively Jewish. It's very clear that it wasn't, but Jews were part of it and became very attached to the institution for all kinds of reasons.
It is interesting how you write it. It's a flow. There's a movement to the book. You start the book off by talking about a certain Jew, Agnon is his name, and you kind of say, well, he kind of traced this route, and as he traces this route, he steps through these different coffee houses and meets different people, and you pick up a number of different historical characters throughout the book, which really makes it flow very well. A question on the history of this. Most of your book focuses on the first half of the 20th century. You talk a little bit into the 50s, 60s, in New York, we talk about that chapter in Tel Aviv, but most of it happens in this early part of the 20th century. You called the golden age of the coffee house from 1848 to 1939. What's special about that era, and why did you focus on this, for the most part, particular era of the first part of the 20th century?
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, So I spoke before about the English coffee house. So actually, the English coffee house was at the 17th and 18th century, and then it declined. But then all over Europe, the middle of the 19th century until mid 20th century, that's the golden age of cafe culture. And you know, I mean, it's always a question where you start. You know, and with this book, it's very clear that there's no kind of fixed beginning and fixed ending, but you have to decide kind of what the period that you are looking at. So I focus on the period between 1848, because this was when, as is well known, the revolutions that swept throughout Europe in Berlin and in Vienna, in the Austrian Empire and in Prussia, and then in Poland, and it even came to the Russian Empire, although it wasn't very successful there. And this is the period where we really start to see the changes that happened in European culture in general, and also in Jewish culture, and also in coffee houses. Because until the mid-19th century, you have some coffee houses, people go there, they socialize, but you don't find this kind of intellectual activity and political activity that is happening. And actually, the period around 1848, coffee houses were places where some of the revolutions were planned. So people used the space in order to plan it, because it was like a little bit away from the public eye, although in some places there were spies from the government. And also the connection that there is between coffee houses and print culture, newspapers, is really crucial. And that's not something that could be widespread before 1848. But that's only part of the story. The other part of the story is that in the middle of the 19th century, you really have Jewish modernization taking place. You know, it started before in the 18th century with people like Moses Mendelssohn and the early Haskalah movement, the Enlightenment movement, but it moves in the middle of the 19th century and at the beginning of the 20th century. This is where the modern Jewish revolution happens everywhere. In Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and then he moves together with the immigrants to America, and then to Palestine. So really, the answer to the period is this kind of convergence that you have between the culture of Europe and modernism, the development of modernism, and the golden age of coffee houses, and suddenly Jewish culture moving away from traditional culture into newspapers and literature, and you know, creating this new culture, and it happened together. So that's, I think, the reason why you have this convergence between modern Jewish culture and cafe culture. Now, why it ends in 1939, where in Europe, that's of course the beginning of Second World War, and that really brought devastation for Jewish culture in most European cities, including in Warsaw and in Vienna and in Berlin. In Odessa, maybe it happened already with Soviet culture that kind of moved away from coffee houses, and Odessa lost some of its importance. So really, it continued after 1939 and after World War II, only in places like New York and Tel Aviv, where you have Jewish immigrants who are coming both before the Holocaust and after the Holocaust, and very often they bring this culture with them from these European cities to the New World, whether it's New York or Tel Aviv, and that continues for a few decades until the 60s and 70s, but the backbone of my book, historically speaking, is between the mid-19th century and the middle of the 20th century, and that's the period of kind of the most intense Jewish culture and Jewish literature, and it's multilingual. It's happening in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in German, in Russian, in Polish, in English, and many of these characters, these people like Agnon that I write about, they are immigrants. They are mostly born in small towns, have traditional Jewish education. They grow up, they are exposed to secular culture. They often speak and read and write in 3, 4, 5 languages. And they are very attracted to these coffee houses. And as they move, very often they don't just immigrate from one place to another and that's it. You know, they move constantly. And so much of Jewish culture in this period is a culture of migration. And you have these networks of migration, and you know, I mean, it's not that historians and literary scholars didn't know this before, but I think they had difficulty showing this network of culture, because we very often think about immigration, right? People are born in Eastern Europe and then they move to New York or they move to Berlin and that's it. But how do you show this kind of culture that is constantly on the move? I found that actually looking at the coffee houses, these are kind of points in what I call kind of modern Silk Road of modern Jewish culture. And, you know, that's the reason why I start with Agnon. I could have started with many other figures, you know, people like Sholem Aleichem or Isaac Bashevis Singer. All of them have similar story of being born in a small town and then moving throughout a number of cities. And then very often what I find, and that's very true in Agnon's writing and also in his life, they go from one city to another and immediately they go to the coffee house because they know that this is going to be the place where they're going to meet other places and where exchange is going to happen. And then they write about it. So Agnon is a very good example, one of many, of somebody who went to coffee houses in a number of cities, and then he wrote about it in his novels and stories in a beautiful way. I mean, it's not in a way that kind of, okay, this is really the experience of what happened. It's very often very ironic. So, you know, I start the book with Agnon, and it's a novel with a fictional character, Yitzhak Kummer, who is kind of based on the young Agnon, but is also a very naive character. So there's a lot of irony there. But through the fiction, the writers really convey to us what did the coffee house mean and how it was experienced by by a lot of people, because that's really one of the important elements that I'm using in my analysis, is this idea of the third space, right? Something that is, it's not really that we have access to the actual place. And anyway, it's all about the experience of people. So, you know, the coffee house becomes this kind of point that is in the middle between the public and the private, between the objective and the subjective, between this history and fiction. And that's why, you know, it's not just that we don't have access to these places and we have to write about it and use all these texts and literature and, as you said, some caricatures and artwork and photographs. It's the fact that what is really important here is the subjective experience of how people experience these spaces. This is what makes them so important, and you know, that's the reason why I'm looking at texts like Agnon to really understand what was going on there, and what was the experience, how people subjectively experienced it.
So what I want to get to is walk through a number of these cities that you talked to, but you mentioned about the photographs, and there's one thing that really struck me about the photographs that you used, and I think it speaks to the importance of these places, but in almost every single picture, until you get into the ones, say, in Tel Aviv or New York in the 1960s and 70s, everybody's dressed up. I mean, this is, and not just dressed up like nicer clothes, but I mean, it's really fancy clothes. It's almost if you were going to the theater or something. The men are all in suits and ties. You see the women coming in these beautiful skirts and bonnets and all these different things. Did you notice that? And is that something that we should take notice of? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. It's true. I mean, I did notice it, and it is in the photographs. It's also occasionally something that people note in the text themselves. And you're right. I mean, it's not, if we have an idea of the coffee house as a home away from home, that you know, people go with their kind of home clothes, it's very different. It is a different kind of space, you know. I mean, maybe here we can mention the famous notion of Jürgen Habermas about the coffee houses, the public sphere. It's a sphere of people, private people coming together as public, right? And I think that the way people dress up is kind of very different from the way we think today about going to a coffee house. But people really went there because it was a place of the public sphere, and you couldn't just go with kind of clothes that you wear at home. It was a place that people see each other. It was a place to be seen. It was a place that you really need to dress up in order to go. And you know, I mean, what's so interesting about it, from my point of view, and that most of the people that I write about, they were actually quite poor. There were a few of them who were more middle class and even wealthy, but most of them were really, you know, they were trying to make a living, and very often they moved away. They went to the coffee houses because they lived in rented cold rooms in the big city, and you know, the coffee house was for them a place that they can get something warm and have access to many things that they couldn't afford, but they had to dress up for that, right? I mean, the other element that your question brings is that, you know, I don't want anyone to get an impression that the coffee house was just this wonderful place of exchange and meeting, which it was, but it was also a place of many tensions, and that's another element that I emphasize in the book. There were tensions around gender, there were tensions around nationality, there were tensions around religion, and there were also many tensions around class and economy. So you have many, many texts when people are talking about how they cannot afford even to go to the coffee house, and they have to borrow money from other people in order to buy a cup of coffee. I know, for example, in Warsaw, there was a very famous place, Cafe Zimianska. There was the, in the interwar period, was a place You know, really for Polish intelligentsia, including many Jews who wrote in Polish, and many of the Hebrew and Yiddish writers, they didn't go there. So I ask myself, you know, why is that the case? Why did they find alternative places, even though everybody knew that Cafe Ziemianska was the center of Polish culture in this period? And you know, the answer is complex. Some of it was the tensions around Jewishness and what does it mean to be Polish, that in order to be Polish, you don't write in Yiddish or in Hebrew. But part of the reason is actually economic, that these people were so poor, they didn't have the money to buy the kind of clothes to go to Cafe Ziemianska. Or to give you another example, in Odessa, the most famous cafe at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, was this place called Cafe Fanconi, that was very different from the cafes that we find in Warsaw or in Vienna or in Berlin even, because Odessa is a warm place, it's by the sea, and it's kind of open to the outside, so you have inside and outside. But it was also a place that by the beginning of the 20th century, it became an expensive place. You need the right clothing to wear, you need to have money in order to order, you know, not just a cup of coffee, but the cakes and the wonderful food that they had there. And, you know, you have Sholem Aleichem and other writers who are writing about it, and they describe it from the point of view of the poor Jews who are coming to the new city. And, you know, Sholem Aleichem writes about it in a very humorous way through the character of Menachem Mendel, who is this a man from the shtetl who thinks of himself as a modern, very sophisticated man, and he goes to the cafe, and he thinks he can learn about what's going on in the world and the newspaper, and then he starts to invest in the stock market, and he wants to make money, and then he loses all the money, and he says, you know, it's not, you go to the cafe, and you can sit there, and then you have access to all these wonderful things, but then you have a waiter in frock, and he comes to you, and he asks you to ask for more. And if you don't have money to ask for more, you are being kicked out, and then outside it's you have some policeman who is probably anti-Semite, who is looking for Jews outside. So there's lots of tensions around the cafe as well. And, you know, your question about how people were dressed up and what went into the cafe, I think it's a good way of thinking about all these tensions and the complex negotiations that were happening in many of these cities.
So walk us through some of these places. You've already mentioned Warsaw, Odessa, Vienna. Another one that you focus on is Berlin. Why did you choose those four cities, and what are some of the similarities that weave throughout these cafes, and what are some of the important differences and lessons that each of these cities talk to us about?
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean, one of the difficult questions with my book is which cities to focus on, and you know, I say in the very beginning, and I want to be clear about it, that there are obviously other places where there were coffee houses and there was significant cafe culture. I wanted to choose these cities as representing kind of the similarities and the differences that you find in Eastern Europe and Central Europe in this period, because what is going on, a lot of what is going on in this period is really the negotiations that happened between Jews from Eastern Europe and the more acculturated and integrated Jews in Central Europe in places like Vienna and Berlin. So a lot of what the book is about issues of acculturation and integration, which are very central to Jewish modernity. But integration and acculturation and emancipation are very different in places like Odessa and Warsaw, where the Russian Empire is in control and Jews are not emancipated. And then both Odessa and Warsaw become alternative to the Pale of Settlement and the small towns the Jews are living in. One of the reasons why I start with Odessa is that Odessa really became this kind of alternative, the city of freedom. It was a new city, but a city that was open to Jews, right? And Warsaw was, until the 19th century, it wasn't a very important place for Jewish culture. But then because of Enlightenment and because of beginning of modernism, many Jews are attracted to this city. So Odessa and Warsaw are very different from each other, but they both represent Eastern Europe in a very good way, and both of them had cafe culture that came from elsewhere. So in Odessa you have people from Greek and from Turkey, from the Ottoman Empire and from Italy and Switzerland opening coffee houses, which wasn't part of Russian culture, and then Jews become very dominant in them. In Warsaw, very similar thing happened, and you have some Jewish owners of cafes and some places that are not owned by Jews. But they're also very different from each other. I already mentioned it, that Odessa, because of the weather and because of the kind of more free atmosphere, these are larger places. They open. In Warsaw, the places tend to be smaller, closed. Some of it has to do with the weather. Some of it had to do with the political activity that is happening, that you want people want to be more inside. As you move to Berlin and to Vienna, it looks very different. It feels very different, right? I mean, people often think about the Viennese cafe as something that is very unique and unprecedented. And, you know, there's even a UNESCO, I begin the Vienna chapter with the UNESCO decision to have Viennese coffee culture, coffee house culture, as one of the intangible cultural heritage sites, right? That gives you a feeling that there's nothing like Viennese cafe culture, that is very, very unique. And it is unique, but from my comparative perspective, it's actually a culture that is moving from one place to another. So together with the uniqueness of Vienna or of Berlin, there's still a lot of similarities, and many places are copying and taking things from one place to another. And then also the Jewishness, the fact that in all these cities, and especially in Vienna and in Berlin, Jews really became identified with cafe culture. In Vienna, there was a famous dictum that the Jew belongs in the coffee house. Now, what exactly does that mean? I think it can mean two very different things. You know, it can mean that Jews feel very comfortable and very much at home in this institution, which became such an important part of the Viennese identity, so they're very well integrated, right? But from a different point of view, it's exactly the opposite. So the Jew, if you say that the Jew belongs in the coffee house, it almost means like they belong in the coffee house and they don't belong anywhere else. And I think both elements really play out in places like Vienna and Berlin, where Jews are trying very hard and are to some degree successful in integrating into the local society, whether it's Austrian or, you know, Prussian and German, and you have very high degree of acculturation, to the degree that that when you look at Viennese culture, Jung, Vienne, so many of the characters are Jewish, right? On the other hand, they feel very alienated from the environment around them, and many of them finding the coffee houses to be kind of places of refuge, right? Also, it becomes kind of places for anti-Semitic attacks, right? Because if the Jew belongs in the coffee house, and if Jews dominate the culture that is in the coffee house, for people who are thinking about nationalism and who belongs in the nation, the Jews become the easy target because they are not from the place, and the whole culture of the coffee house is something that is, as much as it's local, it's also seen as something that is alien and comes from elsewhere. So I find all these dynamics really fascinating, and then you also have this element of the multilingualism of the cafes that are very important in Europe and also in New York and even in Palestine and Israel, that against the pressure of nationalism and monolingualism, the coffee houses are always places where you have German and Yiddish and Hebrew all mixed together, and Russian and Polish and in other places, and that's something that is really crucial in terms of understanding of Jewish culture and Jewish identity in this period, that it's multilingual, and you have in the coffee houses the exchanges between all these languages and the world of the immigrants who are bringing, whatever the immigrants are bringing with them as part of this world. So as much as each place, each city, and each chapter in my book is looking at the unique elements of the development of coffee houses and the city itself, I'm also constantly comparing and looking at the movement and these kind of networks of Jewish migration that really uses the coffee houses are really these kind of anchors on the map of Jewish migration and the migration of Jewish culture.
It is migration, but it's migration that happens in places and then the culture gets reformed. And let me step you back to Warsaw, which I thought was a very interesting chapter because there's a lot of tensions here. Warsaw becomes a Jewish metropolis where roughly a third of the population is Jewish in the early 1900s. And culture starts to be remade there. The modernist culture is really reformed a lot of times in these coffee houses. And you talk about a writer's club. Tell us a little bit about that, how the coffee house informs the literary movement at the time and how the literary movement in turn shapes our notion of what it means to be Jewish.
Right. So, Warsaw is a very interesting case because you have a very distinct culture and coffee houses. At the beginning of the 20th century, there's actually an area of many Jewish immigrants around the Nalevsky Street, and then you have a coffee house like Kotik's Cafe. He's an immigrant from Lithuania who is coming to Warsaw, and you know, there are many small cafes in this very Jewish area, although it was never exclusively Jewish, because it was also the business area of Warsaw. And that was an area where the beginning of Jewish modernism in Warsaw is being created. Many of the young writers who are moving out of small towns in Eastern Europe are coming. But this is still in the context of Congress Poland, that Warsaw is under the Russian Empire, and you have the Polish element on one hand, and you have the Russian element on the other hand, and somehow Jews are caught in between, and also, you know, the multilingual element between Hebrew and Yiddish and Russian and Polish. Then after World War One, you know, the interwar period, in all these different cities, you see something quite different. After World War One, suddenly Warsaw is not part of Congress Poland, and it has nothing to do with the Russian Empire anymore. Now it's part of a Polish state, right, with nationalism. And, you know, I mentioned Cafe Ziemianska before. That was the place in the center of the city that attracted many Jews who are writing, or people from Jewish background, because there's a lot of intermarriage and even people who convert to Christianity, but they really remain Jewish in a cultural sense. But people write in Polish, and they are attracted to places like Cafe Ziemianska. But many, many people who are loyal and want to create a Jewish culture in Yiddish or in Hebrew and are committed to Zionism or socialism or, you know, but don't want to be completely kind of assimilated into Polish society, they feel like going to Cafe Ziemianska is not really the place for them. It's not a place that they feel comfortable. Partly because of anti-Semitism, partly because the question of Polonization. So in this period, they kind of find alternative with the Writers Club. It was really just kind of, it was really kind of an association of writers and journalists, but in order to thrive, it really functioned like a literary cafe. You know, it had food and drinks and cultural activities, and it was basically open to everybody, even if it was a professional association of sorts. You didn't have to have a membership card in order to go. And it was a very hectic place. It was a place that hundreds of people came, and there were many debates in it, and obviously some people felt comfortable in, and some people didn't feel comfortable. You know, Isaac Bashevis Zinger described how he came as a young person to Warsaw, and he was immediately drawn to this place. And it was a place with a lot of conflicts happening, but it was also a place that really fostered the kind of modernism that happened mainly in Yiddish, when you have a group of young writers rebelling against the older ones and inventing new styles and publishing new magazines. And actually, it's interesting to see how they're not going to Cafe Ziemianska, but they are very much aware of what's going on in Polish culture, and they borrow many of these elements. So you have this kind of cultural influence that is moving between one coffee house and the other. And, you know, similar things are happening in other cities. So, you know, I mean, we haven't spoke yet so much about New York, but, you know, if you compare Warsaw or Vienna to New York, it seems like it's a completely different world, right? I mean, it's in the Lower East Side, it's in the context of American immigration with millions of people coming from Eastern Europe in a very crowded, poor place, and yet, you know, these people are bringing this cafe culture from Eastern Europe with them to the New World, to America, and there also you have modernism that is created, and one of the kind of funny things, but also important things that are happening with these cafes is that you have a group of writers who want to declare themselves as a new modernist movement. How did they do it? Very often they move away from the cafe that was associated with the older writers, and they find a new place that is small and mostly unknown, preferably cheap, because these are poor people, and they go there and they establish the new modernist movement just by the very act of moving from one more established cafe to another place. So you can really look at the history of Jewish modernism in so many different cities by following kind of the footsteps of people moving from one cafe to the other.
Let me move us on to these last two chapters that you have, New York City and Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is a destination. It's a city that's new, it's modern, it's being created by Jewish movement. And what is unique about these two places relative to the European, the Central and Eastern European places that you talk about?
Right. Yeah. So one of the interesting elements here in the entire book and project is that, you know, we spoke about the history of the coffee house, and we know that it started in the Ottoman Empire, but then between the 17th and the 20th century, it really became known and experienced as a European institution, right? So the question was always, can it exist outside Europe? Can it exist in New York? Can it exist in America? Can it exist in Palestine? And how different it is in these places? So that's kind of a central question that becomes for a lot of people, whether it's in New York or in Palestine and later in Israel. In New York, I mean, one thing that becomes very clear is that in the 19th century, cafe culture is almost non-existent in America and even in New York. You have saloons, you have bars, you have places where Walt Whitman and Bohemians are gathering, but you don't have much of coffee house culture. And that changes, actually, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, together with the immigrants. I mean, it happens also with Italians and with other immigrant groups, but it also happens very clearly with the Jews, the East European Jews. And then you have people like Hutchins Hapgood and Henry James coming to New York, and they expect to see these very poor people, and they're amazed to see these intellectuals gathering in these cafes. And, you know, so it becomes really interesting to see whether this is a kind of copying a European institution into the New World in New York, or whether there emerges something like a distinct American cafe culture, which is something that I ask as we move from the Lower East Side and the early 20th century to places like Café Royal that developed, in the area not of the Lower East Side, but what we call today the East Village on 12th Street and 2nd Avenue, where the theaters were. And it was a huge place, and it was very popular for Jews and non-Jews, but it was really a center for Yiddish theater and for Yiddish press all the way until the 1950s, when it closed down. So that's the kind of dynamics that happen in New York. In Palestine, what I found really fascinating is that the early immigrants who are coming from Europe, some of them are not aware of the fact that, you know, they think that they bring a European institution in Palestine, but some people are very aware of the fact that there is actually an Arab a coffee house culture that is more connected with the origins of the coffee house than the European one, right? So Agnon, with which I began my book, he writes a novel about early 20th century Jewish immigrants. And when he writes in Hebrew about the coffee house, he insists in calling it Bet Kahava, which in Hebrew kind of replicates the Arabic name, Kahawa, for coffee. And in this way, he kind of really reminds us that coffee houses, the whole culture of coffee houses originated in the Near East in the context of Islam and Arabic culture. And he himself is very attuned, and other characters, you know, in the literature, and in also when people write about it, they are very attuned to the negotiation between Levantine, Arabic, local Mediterranean culture and the European culture that people are bringing with them. Now, there's also tension here around Zionism, because actually for Zionism, this is something that goes back to Vienna and to Herzl, who writes this novel Altneuland, which is a utopian novel about Zionism and the move to Palestine, which actually begins in the Viennese coffee house. And for Herzl, even though he was a regular, he was a habitué of coffee houses in Vienna, he really saw it as something very negative. Right? Jews, the coffee houses in this novel for Herzl, it's a dead end. It's something that symbolizes the decadence and the inability of Jews to live in Europe. And when he writes about the new existence in Palestine, there are no coffee houses at all. And actually, the people who established Tel Aviv in the neighborhood, the first neighborhood, Ahuzat Bayit, that separated itself from Jaffa, so there were coffee houses, Arab coffee houses in Jaffa. There are actually also German coffee houses with some German immigrants. But when they established the new neighborhood of Ahuzat Bayit that became Tel Aviv, many people thought that there shouldn't be any coffee houses, because that's too much similar to diasporic Jewish culture and also to the Arab culture. But of course, the immigrants who came from Europe brought this culture with them. And by the 20s and 30s, there were hundreds of coffee houses in Tel Aviv. And that's what I found so fascinating with, on one hand, you have Zionism and nationalism and the push towards monolingualism and Hebrew culture. So you have Hebrew culture that is being created by immigrant writers. But the coffee houses are always multilingual, and they always bring people who speak Yiddish and Polish and Russian, and you have all these people who are coming to visit from New York and from Europe, or immigrants who constantly compare, and they say, okay, you know, now we have places like Ferretsky and Sheleg Lebanon, some of these places had Hebrew names, and they say, well, this reminds us very much like the coffee houses in Warsaw and in Vienna and in Berlin and New York, and some of them were very happy about that. That okay, for some people it was kind of a sign that this is a viable place for Jewish culture because you have coffee houses in these cities. But there were many other people who wanted to fight against it, who thought that Tel Aviv is going in the wrong direction and hated the fact that the coffee houses in Tel Aviv were always multilingual places and places of mixture, and they thought that the new nationalism and the creation of Hebrew culture really needs to move away from all that. So the culture in Tel Aviv and the coffee houses in Tel Aviv is really important. It's really important and interesting, and in some sense it's different, but in other senses it's also very similar. So you have this kind of diasporic Jewish culture that continues all the way, not just in the 30s and 40s, but even to the 50s and 60s, when you have a new generation of Sabras, people who are born in Palestine and have Hebrew language as their spoken language and don't really know this kind of diasporic Jewish culture that was so crucial in the earlier period. But that's also I think the time when the specific coffee house culture that I'm talking about and how it kind of merges with modern Jewish culture, that's where it ends in the 60s and 70s.
Your book does conclude with that well-titled chapter called Closing Time, and it gives you the visual of a cafe owner wiping down the last tables in the evening as the crowd slowly leaves, and you have these two pictures near the end of that chapter that are just very a visual representation of this whole thing. One is a cafe casit in Tel Aviv right around midnight, and you see the owner sleeping in a chair just outside there, and then there's another one with a customer just kind of sitting there with a resigned look on their face. Like, you know, the earlier pictures were much more vibrant, and this one just seems to be a kind of an existential sigh of a time that has passed us. Tell us a little bit about the passing of this coffee culture.
Yes, so this is a big question, and I admit that it's still a question, and I take a somewhat maybe controversial stance here by saying that whatever existed, it doesn't really go beyond the period of the 60s and 70s. And Café Cassit is a very good example of that, with kind of the closing of the place and the passing of the owner. And you know, what I found interesting is that, you know, I spoke before about how in Europe it's very clear that by Second World War everything is being devastated and ruined, and you don't have much of Jewish culture in these places. But one of the questions that I couldn't find a good answer to was, okay, so if in Europe it died with Second World War, why it didn't continue in places like New York and Tel Aviv and places where contemporary Jewish culture is happening? Because I found that both in Tel Aviv, with the Café Cassit being the last one of its kind, and also in New York, it happened more or less around the same time. By the 1970s, you have kind of an end of an era. So, you know, why is that the case? And you can find local explanation for that. You know, in the context of New York, you can see that most Jews are moving to the suburbs or moving to the Upper West Side. They also become more affluent. They have the apartments that they can meet people. And kind of the culture doesn't need the coffee houses anymore. So that's a local answer to the question. But then why the same thing happened in Tel Aviv, where you don't have this kind of suburbization happen, and still Tel Aviv is very much the center of Israeli culture until today, and you have similar things going on in Jerusalem. And and I think that the answer that I found that so much of the specific culture that I'm talking about was about Jewish migration, and that these places were very important for people who came from other places and found the cafes to be something that reminded them of the other places that they came from, and also the multilingualism that was going on and the exchange that was going on. And by the 70s, you have distinct Jewish cultures in places like New York and Tel Aviv, but they become very localized. You have second and third generation of people who are born in these places, and the experience of the migration doesn't exist anymore. So although there are many coffee houses, and actually there are even more coffee houses in today and in the period after the 1970s, the kind of the unique culture that I see, that I follow in my book, really ends toward the end of the 20th century. And then, you know, it becomes a really interesting question whether, you know, the changes with technology and, you know, we started this conversation by saying that both you and I, we still like to go to coffee houses and to watch people and even to think and to write there. But I also feel that when I go to a coffee house today, it is very different. The technology is a large part of it. I mean, people go to coffee houses and they interact less with each other. You know, the sociability and the meeting and the exchange and the debates are becoming less important. It's either people on their own in front of their computer or, you know, I mean, I think that part of what was going on, that the kind of exchange that I'm talking about in the book, it now moved to the internet. And if we think about it, you know, so many of the chat rooms and you know, in the early days of the internet, it was called cafes, like virtual cafes. And I think that has something to do with the dynamics that is going on. So, you know, I'm also want to be careful because, you know, there is a kind of narrative of decline of coffee houses, and we heard it before. I mean, for Habermas, the decline already happened in the beginning of the 19th century, and for other people, it happened in the middle of the beginning of the 20th century. So, you know, we never know. Maybe this culture will develop again. But I feel that right now, it's very, very different. And even more importantly, in the context of Jewish culture, I'm not aware of many places in any of the cities, including Tel Aviv and New York, where you have this kind of combination and meetings of so many writers and artists and movements that are being created, and coffee houses are so crucial to them. And you know, I end the book with a few examples of people who are writing and reflecting about that. So one of them is Aaron Appelfeld, who just died about a month ago, and he used to sit and write in Jerusalem coffee houses, but he connects it to Europe and to the fact that he still remembered his father in Chernovich, and he still experienced in the 50s these immigrants who were coming, Holocaust survivors, etc. There's also a wonderful novel by Michael Idov, where he writes a kind of postmodernist novel about an attempt of a young immigrant from Russia to America who tries to open a Viennese-style coffee house in the Lower East Side, and then it fails. You know, after a year, he has to close it down. It's a wonderful novel where you kind of see how there is a nostalgia, an attempt to recreate it, but it's kind of impossible. And you know, the last text that I write about is a wonderful film called Cafe Nagler, by an Israeli woman whose family remembers this coffee house in Berlin that was legendary in the family, and then she travels to Berlin and she finds that the place not only doesn't exist and it doesn't, there's nothing in there, but also the whole story that the family told there is not exactly what we find in the historical records, which is for me a wonderful way to kind of close the circle and go back to all these ideas about the third space and how so much of what happened and the culture of the coffee house is very much subjective. It's something that is between the private and the public and the subjective and the objective, and so much of what was going on there was the way people experienced it.
Definitely, and we really pick up the vibe of how people experienced these various tensions, various creative synergies throughout the entire book. The book is titled A Rich Brew, How Cafe Created Modern Jewish Culture. A wonderful read, a very vibrant read that'll take you back to a different time and place and make you wonder about, will we ever recover that? My guest today has been Professor Shachar Pinsker. Shachar, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.